Dude, we are going to energize the country.
We need to wake up and smell the coffee.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Another future is possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Lauren Davison, who is one of the co-hosts of the Left Wingers Podcast. Welcome to the podcast, Lauren.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Now, the first question that I'd like to ask is, why did you decide to make the Left Wingers podcast? What prompted you to decide to start the podcast?
I mean, for me, I think having lived in a constituency, well, I used to live in Totnes constituency, there were very few young people, very few young Labour members involved. And I thought, well, why not create something so that people who might be in a similar situation could have a listen and sort of feel that they were listening to a conversation they might have with their mates in the pub. It kind of, not as a substitute for those friendships, but as a kind of way of reaching out and making people feel a bit more seen. Because if you don't have those friendships in person, it can be really difficult and isolating if all you have to go on is Labour Twitter. It's one of those ones, it can be quite an alienating experience. But I also think education is a big part of it, because so often as younger Labour members, I mean, I'm nearly 25, Brandon and Ross, my co-hosts, are a bit younger than me. There's so much like patronising of young members, even when it's like educating us on important stuff. What we wanted to do was kind of show that you can have conversations about policy issues without being patronising, without talking down to people, and just kind of having good faith discussions that focus on informing rather than sort of castigating because people don't know stuff.
Do you think that part of the reason that people are attracted to podcasts like Left Wingers and some of the other Labour Party podcasts that have come out over the last few years is because not just the educational part of it, but it's not quite as factional as Labour Party, particularly young Labour interactions can sometimes be.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. That's something I think we looked at as well when we were setting up Left Wingers, was that, you know, two of us are open Labour. One of us isn't. So for us, it was important that we bring voices from across the party together in a way that doesn't alienate those who might not be from the same strain of part of the party as us. So like, for example, with the upcoming NEC elections and the Young Labour elections, we want to talk to people from across the party and represent everyone. And I think that is something that, yeah, is really attractive to younger members, because I think when you go to a CLP for the first time as a young member, you kind of get adopted into a faction, and it can be hard to break out of that. I think that's my experience anyway. I was adopted into the more sort of further left momentum faction. I'm now open Labour, but it's really hard unless you've got those, unless you're listening to those conversations from people outside of your bubble. It's very easy to stay in that bubble, and that's the exact opposite of what we need as a party.
Now, one of the things that I think you drew really well on the podcast is discussions of policy and explaining particular policies to an audience that might not be inherently familiar with them. Do you think that that's something that the Labour Party itself could do a bit more of in helping younger members to feel at home within the framework of the party?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this goes probably beyond younger members as well. I mean, as a policy officer for my last CLP, I found it absolutely baffling the lack of support the party gave people like me to try and disseminate information to members of all ages. You know, before the last election, there was basically no support given. There was no way of helping others to understand the sheer amount of policy we had. And let's not forget, the last manifesto was overloaded. And it's about stripping things back and saying it in a way that people understand without, again, being patronizing, because that's not what you want. But there has to be that level of recognition from people that maybe are very involved in politics like we are, that not everyone lives and breathes politics. Not everyone sits there and extensively researches policy areas, and that's okay. You know, that's not, it's not a requirement to be a Labour Party member, but we need to recognise that, and we don't want to alienate people. It's all about making people feel they've got a stake in the party, and if they don't feel like they're being valued and heard and included in policy discussions, they will just turn their back on them and not get involved.
Do you think part of the issue as well, and you touched on disseminating policy there, do you think part of the issue is just basic organisational structure within the Labour Party, that more emphasis has to be put on ensuring that the individual CLP organisations are up to the task of, you know, not just getting out there on the doorstep and handing out leaflets, but also ensuring that everyone is on the same page in terms of message?
Yeah, I agree with that completely. I think there is a structural issue. I think part of it does stem from the fact, though, and I can't say whether my experience in the Southwest would be the same as someone, you know, in a target seat in London, because obviously Totnes was very, very Tory dominated. We were never going to win the seat. Maybe had I been in a marginal seat, my experience might have been different. And I think that's a problem, though, because how do you ever expect to go from marginal to winning a seat if you're not putting CLPs on a fairer footing? I know we're all volunteers at the end of the day. We're all doing our bit. Some of us have no background in the in what we're doing. We're just doing it because we want to help out and we want to, you know, take the party forward. There does need to be a recognition that resources are spread unequally, and there isn't a great deal of understanding of that from some people. Like, I've spoken to people that can't comprehend the fact that some CLPs don't even have a constituency office or a headquarters. It's difficult, because being part of Labour is not a universal experience, and I don't think some people understand that, especially those at the top.
Now, you mentioned then being a member of a CLP in the Southwest, and this is something that I know that you've talked about quite a bit, in terms of perhaps the Labour Party needing to focus more on making gains in the Southwest. Do you think that part of the issue sometimes when the party is approaching campaigning and where to send campaigners is that there is this sort of, well, the North is perhaps more open to us and more of a safer area, whereas the South, even if it is the Southwest, is much more likely to be Conservative or Liberal Democrat, so we shouldn't bother?
Yeah. Totally agree with that assessment as well. I think that's something we've seen in the Southwest. I don't blame anyone in particular for that, because when you're desperately trying to chase the Conservative Party, you're going to go for the seats and the regions where you've traditionally had a really strong standing, and that hasn't always been the case in the Southwest. You know, we've got great pockets of support in Exeter, got great support in Plymouth, really two strong, good candidates. One of them, obviously, sitting MP Luke Pollard. Charlotte Holloway ran for the other Plymouth seat, was brilliant as well. But there is a tendency to kind of double down and go, well, they've always voted Tory or Lib Dem. The Lib Dems are seen as the traditional opposition party in the Southwest. Why bother? And I think it's really encouraging to see Keir Starmer come out and say that rural and coastal towns, especially, are going to be a target for him as Labour leader, because I think people look at places like Torbay and Totnes, where I was. I'm now in Stoke, but, you know, I was there for a substantial amount of time. Look at places like that and think, well, they've got nothing in common with our red wall seats or our heartland seats in London, when actually they do. They face the same issues. They face deprivation, poverty, lack of funding. Some issues are different, but fundamentally the same issues people care about, they just maybe manifest in different ways.
Now, you mentioned earlier on about doing a podcast about the up-and-coming Young Labour and NEC elections. How have you found the campaigns that have been going on for Young Labour and the NEC elections this time round? Do you think that there's been perhaps a bit more intensity because most of the campaigning is going to be online? Or do you think that it's a positive thing to campaign more online in these elections? What do you think?
Okay, so it's quite a multifaceted issue, this one. If I had to describe the campaigns that are going on at the minute in one word, I would say toxic.
Yeah.
That's a general point, not based on anyone in particular, but just the general atmosphere. And I think a lot of people, especially younger Labour members, feel totally alienated from Young Labour as a result. Being online has its positives and it has its very clear negatives, as I think a lot of us have seen. Positives being it engages people that maybe don't live in places like London, where a lot of meetings and rallies and stuff would be going on and they wouldn't be able to get to. The negatives, it's such a, I'm trying to think of the word, it's being put under a magnifying glass where in person, if you was to make a criticism of a candidate, it might reach sort of 5 to 10 people, whoever's in the room. If you tweet about a candidate, it can get hundreds and thousands of likes and retweets. So less so for the lay member, but more so for the candidates themselves. I know firsthand from friends that I've spoken to who are running, the extreme pressure and issues it's causing for their mental health, just being under that level of scrutiny, because it's not all good faith arguments and attacks are being made. It's a lot to deal with, and I couldn't do it myself personally. That's all I'll say. So fair play to them, because I couldn't do it. I wouldn't be able to deal with it. The NEC is a little bit different. I think there are probably people that are a little bit more resilient because they're older. They've done it before. Personally, at the moment, I'm working on Anne Black's campaign. I'm doing a lot of her graphics. And, you know, that's been a really rewarding and lovely experience. I think there is a level of factionalism that's come into the fore, and it's not always helpful. It causes a lot of problems. And as I'm sure you know, it's dragging on for ages. I think next time they need to be a lot shorter.
Do you think that part of the issues aren't just factionalism, but it's also a sense that perhaps Young Labour isn't necessarily as relevant as perhaps it could be to the lives of Young Labour members, where there's a feeling that, oh, it's a great organisation to be a part of if you can get elected, but a lot of people obviously won't get elected and won't feel a part of it.
Well, yeah, look, I think Miriam has done a fantastic job, by the way, in her role. I think that's the very nature of an organisation that seeks to represent young Labour members, but it's still quite a large cohort, and it's quite a diverse cohort in terms of age, because you've got people from the age of 14 up until 27. I think there's always going to be that level of not conflict, but kind of, it's a very sort of broad stroke against a very large group. So your experiences at 14 are going to be massively different when you're 27. If I was on the younger end of that spectrum, I think I'd feel probably quite reluctant to engage as much when there are quite older people there. And I know a few of the candidates are looking at kind of splitting Young Labour off from like younger and older, which I think is probably a good thing to do in terms of not just the confidence of younger members, but for safeguarding reasons as well, because you could have a situation where you've got a 15-year-old sat in a room with a 26-year-old. It worries me a little bit, to be honest. But I can see why people are put off, and I can see why the engagement isn't always there.
You mentioned safeguarding there, and of course, one of the things that has been a large part of Keir Starmer's pitch as leader of the Labour Party is more of an emphasis on looking at cases, whether they be of anti-Semitism, of other issues, and making sure that these cases are resolved. Do you think that if there is a more resilient system of reporting instances of things that aren't right, do you think that that would make people feel safer in engaging in whether they be Younger Labour elections or other elections in the Labour Party?
I mean, obviously I can't speak for Jewish members of the party. I can speak for sort of, I can only speak for myself really. I can't really speak for Young Labour members either. But I don't think until the complaint system is truly independent will there be an adequate level of confidence in it. And that's something I'd like to see pushed for, because we've seen all too often, we've seen it leaked, we've seen comments made that the leader of the opposition has got involved and has, you know, put pressure on for things to be done in a certain way. And I don't think that's right. But on a personal note from my own experience, I've noticed since David Evans has come in, there has been a real shift in the way complaints are responded to, just from little things like the acknowledgement email you get after you've complained. And trust me, I've had to complain quite a bit in the last sort of few months, anti-Semitism and stuff. But I think Evans has come in, and I don't know whether it's something he's consciously done or just the way things have fallen, but it seems as though that action's been taken quicker and it's been taken seriously. So that is a good first step. But as I say, I think independence is truly the way that people will feel confident in the system.
Now, one particular area that I know that you very much know your stuff is law and order, is justice, is crime policy, criminal policy. What do you think the Labour Party's approach to policies involving crime and criminal justice should be going forward? Do you think that there has been perhaps too much of a focus on the amount of police officers on the beat than perhaps reforms to the criminal justice system, or what are your thoughts?
I think Labour's had quite a complex history with law and order, because I think under Blair and Brown, I don't particularly like the direction we travelled in terms of law and order. Quite a few criminologists would argue that New Labour were more Thatcherite on law and order than Thatcher was herself, which I can kind of see when you've got things like the IPP sentence and ASBOs, etc. I think under Corbyn, it was probably one of my biggest disappointments, because he was so liberal and he was so left-wing. You'd kind of expect that Labour would be putting forward our stance on law and order a little bit more strongly. And I don't feel like that was ever done. And I feel like there was a real opportunity missed. But then I'm not going to give my opinion on Richard Bergen. It's for the best. But I'm really pleased that David Lammy's now Justice Secretary, I think, you know, or Shadow Justice Secretary. Got a bit ahead of myself there. But he is someone, I think, really appreciates evidence-based policy. And that is all I'm asking for as a criminologist. All I want is the Labour Party to look at evidence and look at best practice and what actually works, because I think the moment you start going down populist lines, I think it's a real slippery slope. And I know we kind of always had a tendency to try and veer slightly to the right on law and order, because we've gone onto the Tories' territory quite a bit. I don't think we can do that going forward. I really don't think it's a good idea. I mean, yes, the public want to see more funding for the police. That is whether our opinions are the same as the public's opinion is another matter. But when they're peddling things like you know, bobbies on the beat, there's plenty of evidence that suggests that more police on the beat doesn't actually reduce crime. It's the same as stop and search. The Home Office themselves came out and said actually there's no discernible impact on knife crime through more stopping and searching. So we really need to get away from parroting Tory rhetoric that doesn't actually reduce crime or improve lives.
There is an opportunity regarding the quite public spectacle the Conservative Party have made of themselves in regard to the internal market bill, when the argument has been made that, oh, well, it only breaches international law in a very a limited and specific way. Do you think that this gives an opportunity for the Labour Party to make a pitch that, well, you know, you can see how the Conservatives are reacting to international law and law and order in general. You can trust us more with upholding the law.
Yeah, I think that obviously that has to be our natural kind of response to it. But the problem is I worry, will it actually cut through? Because the kinds of people that are still supporting the Conservative Party are the kinds of people that want Brexit at any and all costs. And I feel as though it wouldn't matter you know, it wouldn't matter whether it breached law, because if people don't agree with the law to begin with, they're not gonna suddenly change their mind, especially if it gets them Brexit. We've seen, obviously, with the Tory party and their response to various, how they've reacted to Shamima Begum as well, and, you know, how making her stateless is against international law. They've tried to do it anyway. They really don't care about international law. They don't care about laws unless it's the working classes and normal people that are breaching them. It, you know, it doesn't, there is no level of consistency between what they say and what they do. And I think the sooner people realise that, the better.
So do you think that part of the reason that there is this continuing support for the Conservative Party in some areas is more down to the image they present and focusing on one very specific policy like Brexit, rather than it actually being people thinking that their record in government is fantastic or that they've done well?
I mean, it's difficult to say for everyone, but I think there are a lot of people that either support Brexit at all costs and see the Tories as the best chance of getting it, whether or not they'll remain Conservative after Brexit's been carried out, who knows. A lot of people also internalise the rhetoric that, you know, austerity, for example, was Labour's fault, and that global recession was Labour's fault. So naturally, they're not going to be supportive of Labour. They're probably going to go for the biggest alternative, which is the Conservative Party. So it's really difficult to say, because I think it is an individualised thing. But I don't always think, you know, people support the Conservative Party because of their shining record in government. They haven't got one. A lot of it is they see them maybe as the least worst option. I don't know.
Do you think that part of it is also the way that they, the public, perceive the Prime Minister, the leader of the Conservative Party, as opposed to the leader of the Labour Party? Because, I mean, I think it's clear that a lot of people at the last election seem to see the difference between Corbyn and Johnson, and perhaps veered more to him because of how they felt about Corbyn than necessarily, you know, really embracing Boris Johnson or the Conservative Party. Do you think that's something that we have to keep in mind when going forward to the next election?
Oh, absolutely. I think just like a lot of people talk about how Corbyn had a group of loyal supporters, there were exactly the same for Boris Johnson. You know, canvassing before the last election, there were a lot of people that said to me, I don't like Boris, don't particularly like Corbyn. I'm not going to vote to put Corbyn in number 10 because of anti-Semitism, because he hates Britain. He sided with every one of Britain's enemies. You know, I don't necessarily agree with the latter part. I mean, the anti-Semitism is undeniable. It's there in plain sight. But I think when it's coming down to people having ideas that Corbyn hates the country, and some of the things he has said were dodgy, people, no matter whether they're Labour or not, there are a lot of seats that are Labour that people are still patriotic. They still love the Queen. They still love the country. It's going to rub them up the wrong way. And I think Boris Johnson does optimism really well. He doesn't really do detail, but he does optimism, and he does like a fluffy kind of conservatism that makes people feel good and optimistic about the future. Just because he says it's going to happen doesn't mean it's going to happen. They don't know that yet. But I think people don't like hearing negative things about the country they live in and that they are proud of. And I think that is a big part of it. Now, with Starmer, I think he's been very careful not to alienate people. I think he's been very careful in what he says. I don't necessarily always agree with him doing so. I think there's a way of doing that doesn't make you look spineless. And I don't think he's always struck the right balance. He has said nothing about transphobia, for example. People are mentioning culture wars. For me, transphobia is not a culture war. It's about people's human rights and their existence. And I think any leader of the Labour Party should be speaking up for trans people who are some of the most marginalized people in society. Mm. And the fact he hasn't done that in the name of optics is what I think it is anyway, is wrong.
Do you think that the contrast between Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer will be more of an issue next year's local elections, Scottish elections and Welsh Assembly elections? Or do you think that Brexit will still be the overriding issue in terms of when people are going to the ballot and voting, whether it be for councillors or representatives in the Scottish or Welsh parliaments?
Well, I think in Wales particularly, I think Welsh Labour have done a really good job. I think there's, you know, polling has shown that they've surged in polls again. Mm. Not the same for the Tories. I think obviously the Tories have lost a lot of support in Wales just because of their behaviour. So I think we might do quite well in Wales. That's obviously not for me to say. I'm not Welsh. In terms of Scotland, it's a little bit more complicated, obviously, with the SNP. To be honest, I don't really know about Scotland, only because it seems very complicated at the minute. There's a whole thing with Richard Leonard, whether we think he should have stayed, whether we think he should have resigned. It's difficult to say, and ultimately, I think coronavirus will probably be more of a indicator than Brexit.
Mm.
Because I don't know if we'll know the full effect of Brexit for a while. So I think it's going to be a case of kind of waiting for that to happen, and then maybe opinions will change.
Mm. We're coming up to the end of the podcast. It's been great speaking to you, Lauren. And I've got one final question. Now, of course, as I mentioned at the start of the podcast and throughout, we've discussed that you're one of the co-hosts of the Left Wingers podcast. And my final question is this. If you could have any person on at all as a guest on Left Wingers podcast to discuss anything, who would you have on?
Oh, this is so easy. Lisa and Andy. I think all three of us love Lisa and Andy on Left Wingers. I felt so inspired by her leadership campaign. I feel like she was the only candidate for me that actually spoke the home truths that needed to be said. I feel like there was a certain level of frankness from her that we didn't get from the other two. I'm working class, I say it as it is, and I feel like she embodies that, and I feel like that's what the Labour Party needed at that particular time. But yeah, I would love her, or Emily Thornberry. There's a bit of a trend here, isn't there? Quite outspoken left-wing women, but you know. No, I think they'd be brilliant, but hopefully one day.
Yeah, hopefully you'll be able to get them on, or hopefully they'll come on this podcast as well. But yeah,
okay, yeah, brilliant.
thank you once again for coming on the podcast, Lauren. If anyone wants to find out any more about Left Wingers, where can they go to find out more about it?
You can go onto our Twitter, which is @left_wingers. And you can listen to us on Spotify. Just search our name and we'll be there.
Great. Well, thanks once again for coming on the podcast. And I hope all of our listeners go over and check Left Wingers out if they haven't already.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. Don't forget that you can subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Podbean, or YouTube. You can follow us @DebatedPodcast on Twitter. Like us, Debated Podcast on Facebook. And if you want to email us, either about appearing or making a comment or reaction to the episode you've heard or any other episodes, then email us thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.